Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1076 with Charles Morgan.
Yes, the first restaurant you open, there's not going to be a second one if that doesn't work, but your second one is the only time you're going to grow 100% overnight. So the second one's got to be good too.
Are you ready for it factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This episode is brought to you by Mies. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary IP and stay in sync, giving the culinary team the ability to both create recipes and distribute them from the same platform. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yield of ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Meez account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at Owner.com/unstoppable and see why Owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest. He asked me to introduce him as the restaurant guy, or a restaurant guy, Charles Morgan. My man, Charles, are you feeling unstoppable today?
I appreciate you asking me on.
Oh man, I'm happy to have you here. Robert St. John put you on my radar, and he said, you got to get this guy on the show. Had amazing things to say about you. You've been in the industry since 1979. Not only do you own a handful of restaurants throughout the South, you also have your own wholesale fish market. So there's a lot of things we're going to talk about today. I'm super stoked to get into it. But before we dive into who you are and how you got to where you are today, let's get that motivational, inspirational ball rolling with a success quote, mantra, core value, something that resonates with you. Take it away.
Common sense in an uncommon degree is what the world calls wisdom.
Common sense in an uncommon degree is what the world calls wisdom. Dive into that. Why does that resonate with you?
That was from Samuel Coleridge.
Okay.
Said that, and it's the approach that we have to just about everything. We're not a there's nothing scientific about this. It's not really intellectually difficult. It's at its very base, it's common sense. And thank God for that, because we've got a little common sense, not enough, but we've got enough to wangle our way through the restaurant world for 40-something years.
I mean, whatever you're doing, man, it's been working. And I think at the end of the day, behind every great restaurant or behind every great restaurant group, there's a commonality that the people behind it are just really great people. They don't have to be the most intelligent. They don't have to be the most talented. But if they have work ethic, they keep showing up, they keep on doing the right thing by others, somehow over time they end up doing amazing things. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think this is an industry in which you had better like people on all levels. Right. And some people just they're not like that. Some people are more reclusive, or you have to enjoy people, because that's how you're going to make a living, and you better enjoy the people you work with, because that's what allows you to do it.
Yeah. Awesome stuff. So where does it make sense to start sharing your story? I know you got your first restaurant open in 1979. Was it always the dream to open a restaurant? Like, how did you find yourself here?
No, it was no dream of mine at all. I have absolutely no business background. My father was a civil rights attorney, and, I grew up in Atlanta. They're just, restaurants weren't what they are today. I try to explain to people, in the late 60s and early 70s, it was really with the advent of the birth control pill that spawned restaurants. And that's okay. Because when women had access to have some control over their body and determine when they wanted to have kids, they joined the workforce. And so the old trope of Leave It to Beaver, where the mom was at home preparing dinner every night, well, they couldn't do that and work at the same time. So when women started coming into the workforce in huge numbers in the 70s, somebody had to cook. And that became restaurants. A lot of the early restaurants, Cork and Cleaver and Houlihan's and TGI Fridays in Atlanta, those kinds of places came about to feed people that had in large part been fed by women,
right,
in the household prior to that. So
is this something that you read in a book or heard, or is this just like an observation, a conversation you have with other restaurateurs? Like, where did the source of knowledge come from?
I didn't just come up with that. I'm sure I read it somewhere. I read a lot.
Yeah.
But and it made sense. Everything
it makes you read total sense. It's never been mentioned on the show before. So that's, I find that really interesting. I love history.
And even then, I mean, if you look at the advancements, if you want to call it that, over the years, women in this industry, you know, not only were restaurants not, they're everywhere now. They weren't like that when I was growing up. Atlanta had really very few restaurants, and those restaurants were all male-dominated from top to bottom, particularly in the back of the house, by men. And that changed. That was one of the changes that came about with women gaining equal rights. And
right, right. At what point did you say to yourself, you know, I want to open a restaurant? When did that come into the picture?
No, well, my path was, I grew up in Atlanta, went to high school there, went off to school. I got a master's degree in American Studies in 1977, and it was a valuable, I read a lot, and there's value to that. I did not learn a profession through going to school, but I learned some things. And I had, fortunately, at about the same time, I got my Coast Guard captain's license.
Okay.
And that did provide a living. I ran a private boat for the Crow's Nest for Strickland Paper Company out of Birmingham, Alabama, when I first moved to Destin. And that was in 77. And then in 79, when we were here, there were six restaurants from the Destin Bridge, which is 1 mile to our west, to San Destin, which is 9 miles to our east. Six total restaurants, and I bet now there's 400.
Oh, right. And there only keeps on, only more are coming, right, as we go into the future.
It sure seems like it.
Yeah.
And we, so that was, there was without, you know, a desperate need. We needed a place to drink beer and stuff, and we didn't want to drive too far to do it. So this was right where we are. We opened on July 4th, 1979. We had six picnic tables, and we had oysters and beer.
Oh, man. I want to get into that, but I'm also really curious, too. You got a master's in American Studies. What would you say is the closest adjacent degree to that? Is it sociology, history? Like, what were you learning, do you think, during this time?
I did my thesis on the literature of disgust. I compared Jean Genet and André Gide to Hunter Thompson and William Burroughs in a paper. So it was American Studies, just pretty much what it sounds like.
What's social studies at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, that would be under that realm.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm always fascinated. It seems like people who study psychology, history, philosophy, and I feel like a lot of those subjects are adjacent to American studies. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know anything about that degree.
They are not. Yeah, okay. None of those things really applied to American studies. American studies is more about literature and sociology and history and all things American, but not in specific... You know, and it certainly didn't prepare you for anything. It's just like anthropology is a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing to study. It's very interesting. However, there's only a dozen jobs in anthropology every year, right. And they're in teaching. So I was kind of in that deal. I wasn't prepared for any sort of job.
But you're studying people. Is that safe to say?
I've been studying people since I was a child.
I think at the end of the day, to really be successful in this industry, it's really just having an understanding over human nature and understanding people. Would you get on board with that?
I think that's one of the secrets to life, period.
Right.
And we misunderstand people. We all do, and we misread people. But the longer you've done it, and if you're concerned about people, and you tend to get better at it.
Yeah. So if your background prior to 1979 had influenced you in any way leading up to becoming a successful restaurateur, in what way did it is what I'm curious about.
Zero. Except for just a general liberal arts. I'm still a proponent of liberal arts education at a time where they're trying to get kids streamlined for jobs. Yeah, it wouldn't have been a bad idea to have had a couple of accounting classes when I was in school.
Yeah.
But I didn't. And to this day, we have restaurants in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where I went. And I have no earthly idea where the business school is. And it's a very small campus. Not a small campus, but I'm around there all the time. I still don't know where it is.
So help me wrap my head. Before we dive into 1979, six picnic tables, oysters, beer, I want to get into that. But paint the picture. Let's start with the end in mind, where you are today. Paint the big picture of where you are today. Because I did some research. I saw, you have restaurants all over the place. I think I counted a total of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Am I even getting close to the amount of restaurants, or is that it?
We have more than that.
Yeah. And it was all over the place. So paint the big picture for me real quick. How many total restaurants?
Well, my kids have taken over these restaurants in Destin, but we have Dharma Blue in Pensacola, which has been there 28 years. Yep. We have a Chuck's Fish in Mobile, Alabama, Chuck's Fish in Montgomery, Alabama, Birmingham, Tuscaloosa, Athens, Georgia, Tallahassee, Florida. We have a Five Bar in Athens and Tuscaloosa. And here we have Camille's. One of my sons has La Paz in Local Market, and another one has Harbor Docks here.
Okay. So I counted, so we have Harbor Docks, one. Dharma Blue, one, right? And then I counted six Chuck's Fish. So we're up to eight total. Five Mobile times two, 10. And then I think you threw two more in there. So we're about approximately 12 restaurants.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And these, like I said, I have very little role. I have no role to play. These, my children run those.
Got it. I want to make sure I had the big picture lined up. And when did the majority of those open? Recently or over the, like,
Chuck's Fish, well, Dharma Blue's 28 years old. Chuck's Fish in Tuscaloosa is 18 years old. Camille's is 20 years old. It was really, we're not real planners. We don't have goals, which I'm not sure that's a great business. We've never been, let's open three restaurants next year. We just, actually, when our staff, when we've got our restaurants are staffed to the point where we're going to start losing people, if we don't, we open another restaurant.
That's huge. I think that is the only reason why you should open another restaurant, because you have to provide the opportunity for the people you're responsible for. Safe to say?
It's all based, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so back to 1979, you were just looking to open the restaurant that you were looking for. Much like the reason why I started this podcast, I was looking for a podcast to learn about the restaurant industry. You're looking for a place to have seafood and beer with your friends, and it didn't exist.
I was looking for a place for me to drink beer. I wasn't the restaurant thing just going to happen.
How old were you?
I was 23. Oh, wait a minute. 79. Oh, I was 24.
24. So you were the target market.
I was what?
You were the target market.
Yeah, this is a, you know, I don't think you can picture what Destin looked like, all these condos and houses. There was nothing. I told you, there were six restaurants for a stretch of 10 miles. There was no target. This was a fishing village, which it's hardly, we'd love to think that it still is, but this market is primarily been fueled by second homeowners and then tourists from New Orleans and Memphis and Nashville and Birmingham and Atlanta. And that's kind of what it's always been. But
so it's like,
just,
like a regional vacation spot.
Yeah, and there's a lot more. And we've always, this is a drive-to place. Yeah. Any of those places I named, you can drive here in a half a day on less than a tank of gas. So it was really almost a recession-proof, not quite, but place to vacation. Yeah. All, you know, you could come here. The beach doesn't cost anything. You don't have to buy lift tickets like you do when you go on a ski trip.
I had a cousin that lived in Columbus, Atlanta, and this was her vacation spot. Yeah. So it's a perfect example.
Yeah, people in the South have vacationed here for a long time.
Yeah. Did I cut you short?
Say again?
Did I cut you short? Were you saying something?
Okay. No.
So one thing I've learned is that for every piece of restaurant advice, good restaurant advice, there's a countering piece of restaurant advice that's just as good. That's completely opposite. So I think you fall into the realm of, if you're looking for something and you can't find it, create what you're looking for. But if you're from that place or you live there, then you're not alone in what you're looking for. Other people will say never reverse engineer what you're looking for, but only reverse engineer what the market's looking for. But if you are the market, you know, like you were a part of the community. Right. So like, I think it all depends. There's a lot of different variables there. So you just were trying to create what you were looking for. What were your earliest challenges like getting this started? Or it sounds like you kind of just decided one day and made it happen.
Yeah. The biggest challenge was we had absolutely no idea what we were doing. I mean, that we were totally ill-equipped to run any kind of business. I was driving a boat. I could do that. But from a standpoint of hiring people and providing food and hospitality to people, we had no experience with that except just growing up with a reasonable background.
Was it a stressful time, or were you just kind of like rolling with the punches?
Well, stressful is the word. It was the Wild West in a lot of ways. We were the rules and regulations. This where we're sitting right here. We dug this out from the sandbank and built this whole place where we never got any permits, no electrical permits, plumbing permits, no health department. Destin wasn't a city.
Right.
We were open probably 8 years before Destin even incorporated.
Okay.
So in that sense, there's that. The other thing, the times were different. You know, those were we're out of the 60s, but into the 70s, and a person that I admired and still do, and he was a very prescient, brilliant guy, was Hunter Thompson. And he was also my role model. And that's probably, in retrospect, not a great role model.
Why is that?
He's just not.
I mean, I know the name Hunter Thompson. Yeah. American
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Okay.
But so we were long hair, bearded, and not just me. And it was a kind of a wide open, very few of the restrictions that we've now come to accept and know and appreciate, we didn't have those then. We wangled our way through it somehow, but it was a very free form of business. It didn't have near, from a labor standpoint, from a federal labor standpoint, from a societal standpoint, the way, but at the basics is sometimes out of control as it was, we were good people.
Yeah.
And we had the basics down to be kind and nice to people, and we've always had that, and that got us through some times that were otherwise would have been very, very stressful.
Did you have a vision back then? Because you kind of already alluded that there was no goals, no plan, but did you have a vision of what you were trying to accomplish?
No.
A dream?
No, not at all.
How long did you have just the one location? 1979 to...
How long did we been here for 45 years?
Yeah, but how long did you only have one location?
How long what?
When did you open your second location?
Let's see. We opened a little grocery store down the road in 81, Odom Central Market. It was the only grocery store in
town.
2 years
later.
When we got it, and we had that store. This was an example of something. We were a little ahead of our time. We had 30 different types of coffee beans in big burlap bags, and that was 2 years before Starbucks opened. There was not a big market for coffee drinkers, however, in Destin in 1981. And so...
Is that still around today?
That lasted a couple of years.
Okay.
We opened a gigantic brewery out by Sandestin called Morgan's, and it was 50,000 square feet with 8 different food venues. We had a brilliant brewmaster from Denver, Colorado, and... I spent one whole year working there trying to sell a lovely pale amber beer with a hint of rosemary to people that wanted Bud Light. That was over 25 years ago. That predated the craft beer thing by about 10 years, probably.
That's what I was thinking, way ahead of the curve.
It was, unfortunately.
Was this in the 90s when you did this? The brewery?
I think it would have been in the mid-90s. Yeah.
Okay. So... Your second oldest, what's your second oldest running restaurant today?
Dharma Blue.
And when did that open?
It opened 28 years ago.
Okay. I'm bad at math. So that would have been 1996. Thank you. Right after the brewery.
Right after what?
Right after the brewery.
Yes.
Around the same time. So as you're opening these things, like what's driving you? Was it just like a design? Were there things you're looking for that you couldn't find? Were you just building them out of necessity? There's no plan, but there's got to be something that would drive you to do it, right?
Well, not really.
Why'd you do it then?
It was just happenstance. I mean, we found the place in Dharma Blue. I went in there one night. The guy looked miserable. Richard Scotto, the guy that owned it, was an Italian restaurant. We got to talking. He wanted out. And I said, well, shit, I like Pensacola. So we did that. And we've, like I said, we've never, La Paz has been here 30 years. That's a Mexican place that my kid has now. Camille's has been here 20 years. There was no playbook for the way we grew.
What in terms of profitability, were you making money out of the gates or did that come with time?
This place has always made money.
Okay.
And at different times it made lots and lots of money.
Okay.
Like I said, there was not as much here, and we got in here early, and we were well-known throughout the South. Right behind you, we had a deck, just a big open deck. We had live music, and the first night we had music at about 1 in the morning. I called the architect and woke him up and asked him what the load capacity was for the deck, and he couldn't remember. He said, why do you ask? I said, because the entire deck is swaying.
There's
about 1,000 people out there.
Wow.
Then at one point, shortly after that, we did that for 20 years. Sometime shortly after that, we were up there kind of amazed at these crowds. And somebody, we had a doorman, and at some point he said, you know, we ought to charge a cover charge. And I don't think I knew what a cover charge was. And I was probably 28 years old. And I said, well,
this would have been in 84, yeah, 5 years after you opened.
I said, well, that sounds like an excellent idea. And so Yeah, this was a rocking place.
So what was it about the business model that made it work in terms of like cash flow? Was it you're charging at the door, you're serving a lot of alcohol, great margins in alcohol?
Yeah, we did. We sold a lot more alcohol than we do today, and it was always very simple. We concentrated, as you can see, we've got commercial boats 35 feet away from here.
Right.
And we've been selling fresh fish for a long time. And from the very beginning, partly because of our location, partly because I was a fisherman, and because it's the way we did it, people trust us with seafood.
Yeah.
And that was before people weren't trusting. People back in those days, people in the South, in Memphis, Nashville, Birmingham, Atlanta, when they ate seafood was when they came to the beach for a week. They didn't. There was no seafood in Nashville or Memphis. And now with transportation and FedEx and fish coming out of Central America.
Refrigerated trucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've gotten much better at moving things that are...
Way too much better. Now the demand for fish dramatically outstrips the supply.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, I'm sure we can get into that when we talk about the future, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're going, what we can do to be more intentional moving into the future. But... I mean, it sounds like if you're having a lot of these, in my experience talking to people, you can't go on and open more things unless location number one is generating the cash flow and you're making money to invest in new things, right?
Well, that's true. And then the adage that I followed, I grew up with a guy that helped start Longhorn Steaks, was that the most important restaurant you open is the second one. You could easily say it's the first one because nothing. The restaurant we just opened in Tuscaloosa 18 years ago, if that one hadn't worked, there wouldn't have been a second one.
Okay. So say that original statement one more time.
The original what?
The statement leading into what you just shared. I don't know if I fully caught the opening statement.
Well, yes. The first restaurant you open, there's not going to be a second one if that doesn't work.
Right.
But your second one is the only time you're going to grow 100% overnight.
Okay.
So the second one's got to be good too.
Got it. So... I think the other variable, we were talking about the fish, but you were buying straight from the source. So you weren't going to a market. There was no upcharge. You're buying from the boat, correct?
And we still are. We opened our seafood market in 81. So last year we bought fish from 150 different commercial boats. We've got a lot of boats here. And then from Biola Battery all the way to Panacea, we buy fish from all kinds of boats.
Is it as easy to do it today as it was then, or is it getting more difficult?
No. Way more difficult.
In a bad way?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's a deceptive way for one thing, but also, you know, chickens, pigs, cows, don't worry, they're going to keep growing those. This is the last source of wild protein that we have.
Right.
And it's very expensive. It's not expensive enough. And last year in Florida, 90% of the seafood sold in Florida was imported. We're surrounded by water.
Right, that's
and
wild.
So you've got mislabeled seafood everywhere. It's an incredible problem.
Yeah, you know, it's scary. When you think about, you know, speaking of American history, you look at what this country was in like the 16th century, 17th century, there was buffalo west coast to east coast. Like, there was elk in New Hampshire. Like, we stripped this country of its natural resources, and it was so long ago today that we have no recollection of what it was like. We're now getting the means to do the same thing to the ocean, and if we're left to our own accord, like, we're going to do the same thing.
We're on our way to that, and it's not just the commercial demand. The commercial fleet here has waned dramatically in proportion to the recreational fishermen. There's boats all around this town. You see these boat barns, and these guys with electronics these days, they can go out there and catch fish.
Right.
And so there's so much pressure on the fish that I don't know where it ends up, but it's not good.
So the mission statement of Restaurant Unstoppable is to inspire, empower, and transform the industry. But really what we're trying to do is change the world. And I think that if you can transform the restaurant industry does have the power to change the world. Third largest industry behind the government and healthcare. And then it's the restaurant industry. And the restaurant industry is so closely connected to the food system, you know, that we have transformative power. So is the message eat less fish, or is it charge more for fish? Like, if we keep eating fish at the same rate, that's the issue. So what is the message? What do we do to get out of this?
I don't know. And then when you throw into the equation climate change, which is, I'm a firm believer that the climate is drastic, it's a problem that I don't know how it works out, but it's going to get more difficult before it ever gets easier. And one of the things, aquaculture, there's a lot of farm-raised fish, shrimp, crawfish, oysters now, and that's providing a lot of the seafood.
I mean, there's this thought that I kicked around with it in the past, having a hospitality-driven economy, where if you want things, you can get it, but you get a tax through the nose for it. If you want to have Gulf shrimp in Alaska and salmon in Florida, you can get it, but you're going to pay a lot of money, and all that money is going to go back to kind of like the hunting, how we, like fish and game. Like it goes back to the systems to manage it, right? Or back to the sources. But also, if you want those things, move the people to where it comes from. So now you're injecting those areas with the hospitality, the tourism, the ecotourism, the food tourism that will not just support the farmers and the fishmongers and all these different people, the fishermen, but like it's going to ripple out to the communities. What are your thoughts of what I'm sharing?
Well, there are already so many rules and regulations in place. These guys here, that Lady Yumboat that's right there, they virtually need an attorney and an accountant and a biologist on board with them when they go fishing. It is so complicated. Wow. The quotas that they fish under are real rigid. So there's lots of things in place to try to, that weren't in place 20 years ago, to try to maintain the fish that we've got.
Who pays for that?
Who pays for what?
To have these extra people on
board. Well, the government. So okay. Those are all federal jobs. Well,
that's not coming out of the fishermen's. They're not covering
that. Okay, we have a good state marine biology thing. It's taxes.
And, yeah.
But it's and again, aquaculture is something, but you could, the amount of fish that are imported from Asia is so dramatic, people are not aware of.
Right. I want to come back to this because I can tell that you're really passionate about it, but I want to save it for like what can we do? Like we talked about, we've identified the issue. And I don't think we've identified a solution yet. And I want to hear what you have to say, but I'm going to bookmark that for later when we wrap up. Back to your timeline. At this point, the year I think I have down, we've made it as far into the future as 1996. You have three, you have one restaurant, one market, a brewery, and your second restaurant at this point. Are all four of those things still going on through 1996, or did you close anything?
The brewery... I think the brewery is the only one that's not. But it lasts about 2 years.
2 years. When did you know it was time to hang up the...
When it was out of money.
Okay. That's a good reason to stop. What are your biggest lessons? At this point, from 1979 to 1996, you're, you know, 15, 16 years in as a restaurant owner and business owner. How have you personally transformed as a business owner up to this point in your story?
Well, for one thing, it was difficult, and I think it's fairly common in a tourist area like this, and this is not really an excuse. I think it's the truth that my friends, would come down here on vacation for a week, and they'd partied every night, and I partied with them. And when they left, another group came, and I didn't realize that they were going back to work when they went home, and they didn't party year-round. So for decades... that we had a horribly misbehaved approach to almost everything. And then I stopped all that in 2005. And that's really when these other restaurants came along. I had extra energy and, not surprisingly, money. We were very successful throughout since we started. But we got more successful and paid a bit more attention as we grew. We've still, this, you look upstairs here, we've got the same people. We've probably got four or five people that have been here 40 years.
Yeah.
And we've got a dozen that have been here 20.
Yeah. So in 2005, you're 26 years into being a business owner. You're 49 years old at this point in your life?
50
years old. So you're kind of evolving and saying, like, I don't want to party every night. I'm getting older. My life is changing gears. And when that happens, you start cutting back on the partying. You're spending less money on that sort of thing. You said you have more energy. Is this when your businesses start to change too?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I wanted the party to end, but it ended.
Yeah.
And when it did...
Out of necessity or choice?
Yeah, both. Yeah.
Okay.
And then it was I had more time on my hands. I was thinking more clearly. And we went to Tuscaloosa, Alabama and opened a restaurant. And if that was just on a whim. And if it hadn't worked, we went to downtown Tuscaloosa and 3/4 of the downtown was boarded up with plywood. And the building that we took over was also...
There's a lot of towns like that in the South. I'm like just driving around. I tried to take back roads on my way here just to kind of take in the scenery, the towns. It was at Yarula Lake. I'm not saying that right. In right on the border of Georgia and Alabama, that lake, that long lake that's right there. What's that lake called? You know what I'm talking about? Just south of Columbus.
Near Eufaula?
Eufaula is what I'm trying to say. Thank you very much. Like that town, beautiful. You drive down the main strip, these beautiful homes. You get maybe a half mile out from those beautiful homes, and it's...
Yeah, well, you haven't spent much time in the rural south.
No, I haven't. Like,
this is different. This has nothing to... It's a different world than the rural south. But Eufaula is a wonderful little old town.
Oh, beautiful.
Town.
Yeah.
But...
Went to a port town after that that was kind of... falling apart too. Do you know what I'm talking about? The southern tip of that.
There's lots of problems with the rural south. No question about it.
Yeah. Does that mean there's lots of opportunity though?
The what now?
Does that mean that there's also a lot of opportunity?
We've tried to help in a couple of rural areas. It's tricky and tough. The labor market's difficult. You know, in some areas in the south, particularly in the Black Belt, it's been very difficult. You know, crystal meth went rampant through the rural South, and the crack cocaine did the same thing in black areas of the South, and it's never quite recovered. Lots of areas. It's been the jobs left, the people, a lot of people left. There was flight, and the rural areas, I think not just here, but around the country.
Oh, for sure.
Very difficult.
I think now's a good time to take a break to thank our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to unpackage that a little bit more.
This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI's services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way.
We're back. And when we left off, you were talking about basically some of the hardships that the southern towns have come across, these mid-market cities. A lot of people left these cities, and you've mentioned that you've tried to turn some of those cities around. I think you're talking about Tuscaloosa, or was that?
No, our experience with that, we have a place in Red Bay, Florida, which is in the country north of here.
Okay.
And it had one little local store, little grocery, that had been there for 60 years, and it just couldn't make it. The last folks left it. It sat empty, so the people in Red Bay had to drive either to Dufuniac Springs or Freeport to get a roll of paper towels. So I gathered 50 of the people in the community to be my partner. They all put in $1,000.
Holy shit.
And we ran an incredible little store and restaurant.
So you raised $50,000.
Raised 50. It was not a money. It was not nearly enough. But
what year was this?
This was
2000.
I'd say a dozen years ago.
Okay,
something like that. And we ran it for 4 years, And we did the best we could, and it was an incredible experience. It's hands down the coolest thing we've ever done. But we got to where, at one point, we had four lawsuits. We had just a couple of handfuls of employees. We had four lawsuits at one time, which is, I had no lawsuits at any of these other restaurants. And it was somebody that said, well, you know, these folks, you know why they're getting a job? So they can turn around and sue you. And I thought, you got to be kidding.
Getting all the lawsuits from employees.
Oh, yeah. All
so, employees. Okay. And this, okay.
It was really disappointing. The labor market, we didn't need much in a place where jobs are desperately needed.
Yeah.
The labor market was horrific.
Do you know why I think the restaurant industry has the power to transform the world?
What's that?
Because it has the power to transform cultures in a community. And if you can take one restaurant and put it into a community and have one person that can empower the people around them, their employees, that those employees will empower the people around them. It's not easy. What I'm saying is definitely not easy. But I think there's just a fundamental issue with culture in the country. And I think the only way we're going to do it is by empowering people and creating opportunity for people and teaching people the values. You know,
well, you see that happening with varying degrees of success around the United States.
It's definitely
happening. Some little small places have pulled it together, but it is remarkably difficult.
But I mean, that's just a testament to we're going back, you said a decade now, and I think that we've come a long way. But there's just a lot of desperate communities out there, and all they know is to work the system because that's what they have to do to survive. So you can't really blame them either. It's what they've been taught.
Yeah, but it becomes a gig of its own, gaming the system, and that's where we were. Not everybody, but the number of people who are on disability, for instance,
right,
and unemployment compensation that went on for it was real disappointing. We tried,
but all you know is all you know. All you can do is all you know, and that when you, I don't blame these people because I feel like it's what they were taught. And that we are all the byproduct of those who came before us. And when all you know is what you're taught, you need to be shown another way, right? Would you agree with that or disagree with that?
Well, I would say that my experience was just an entire generational breakdown that was exacerbated by crystal meth in rural areas. And by, to some degree, crack cocaine.
The drugs absolutely did not help.
Oh, it just destroyed kid people. The number of people that could fit in a prison, you know, that didn't help. People that, for whatever reason, apparently aren't fond of birth control, having children with no family structure at all. And I've got four kids. I know how difficult it is. And you would see people where at that point, when you've got a teenage mom and three kids, virtually nobody has a shot.
So when you went into this community, you raised the $50,000, what was the goal? Was it just to open a restaurant or was there something higher there?
Again, I have a horse farm up there. And part of the goal was that I would have a place to drink coffee.
Okay.
And that's what...
So before you're looking for a place to drink beer and have oysters, now you just want a place to drink
coffee. Now. But... And again, we had people from all over the place. We didn't have much press, but there were people from all over that would come through there and say, how can we do this where we are? And it was very difficult since we weren't real successful with it. It wasn't the template you'd want to follow, but we couldn't. There was no other template to it. We gave it a shot, and the pieces and parts that it takes to make something successful just weren't there.
What pieces, what parts specifically were missing?
Workers. People that had, I'm not talking about skilled workers, I'm talking about people that could just, and to this day, we'll talk about it at some point, but when you talk about plans, our restaurant group as a whole, all these restaurants, we have the thinnest employee manual you have ever seen, and the number one rule, and the main rule, and almost the only rule, is you have to be on time to work for us. We give you three shots at it, and if you don't, of course, we're reasonable. If you've got a flat tire, if your grandmom died, one grandmom, not three. But we found that people that are on time generally tend to be better workers, and that was just out of, you couldn't get anybody to be on time. That was a task beyond our accomplishments.
So during our break, you stepped away real quick, and I was talking to who was I talking to?
Tony Martin.
Tony Martin, and who's Tony's been here since it was his first job.
He's been here 39 years. He's my partner in the seafood business.
Partner in the seafood. Was he your partner when you first got started?
Or no.
Okay. He was young then.
He was about 20.
Okay. I was talking to him, and I was trying to dig a little bit, trying to get some information. I was asking him, what should I talk to Charles about? He said, he extends trust and his management. And I think you're alluding to this is you have very loose rules, but you're good at giving trust. And what happens when you give trust?
Well, part of that's because I'm lazy. You know, I prefer someone else to do stuff.
I don't know any lazy people that are able to find 50 people to raise $1,000 from each.
That was a couple of days there. I wasn't lazy.
I think you're modest. They, which is a good skill. It's a good trait.
No, but Tony's the most fun that I had during the entire COVID thing when we would get restaurants would get open and people were just starting casual conversation. They'd come up to me and just with a heartfelt look, just say, can't imagine what you're going through. Nobody wants to work. Everybody's sitting home. We cannot even imagine. And when they finish, I just say, nope. I said, we're fully staffed and have been throughout the entire pandemic. And first, they'd be taken aback. And then they'd realize I wasn't bullshitting. And I like for them to have to walk away from that. It was me bragging without them realizing it. Why is it that everybody we talk to can't find labor, and he hadn't had a problem.
So what's the answer?
We do it right.
So I've learned that if there's a yin and yang to this industry, and if there's a balance, it's a balance between systems and culture. I think that you can be extremely successful if you have amazing systems and you're doing maybe one or two things really well. You can also be extremely successful if you have this outstanding culture. And it sounds like from what I'm gathering is that you lean in the direction of having an outstanding culture, and the culture keeps people in place and the culture gets people to show up and work hard. I think the sweet spot for most people is having good systems and culture. That's where most successful operations run. But I think if you have extremes in either of those directions, it's also possible.
Yeah, our systems virtually don't exist.
So if we're looking to become successful, to own upwards of 16 locations, is that what I, in all? Was that where I was at?
Something like that.
How do we do it on culture? If we're trying to build an empire on culture, what is your advice for us?
Have your people be on time to work, first of all. And beyond that, And instead of goals and core values and those kinds of things, you can put stuff on paper and people are going to figure out real quick whether you're full of shit or not. And the values from top to bottom in our group, we want people to see who we are and how we operate. One of the things we do at all of these stores that are far flung in different places where I can't be, we let everybody know. We tell them what we'll do for them. A lot of our employees are college kids in these college towns, and they get in trouble, and they don't have a lawyer. They need to borrow money, and they don't have a relationship with the bank. They need a down payment to rent a house, and they don't have those kinds of savings. And we tell them right up front, if they'll do what we ask them, we're going to help them. And what ends up happening is everybody doesn't get in trouble. Very few people do. But when somebody does get in trouble, we help them. And everybody sees that, and it gives them that sense that there's a security net under them, that they know it's a good feeling to know that if something happens, we're going to be there for them. And we've done that for many, many years in 1,000 different ways. And that, to me, is a more powerful way of building a group of people who will do the right thing when nobody's watching, because they care about the people they work for.
What I'm picking up is you got to give before you get. You got to give trust. You got to give loyalty. You got to give support. You got to give love before you ever expect to get it in return. And you can't do it because you want to get it back. It's just the right thing to do.
I think those things are way more important than rules or values or stated values. I think from a management perspective, when I tell you that we are weak, one of my favorite anecdotes is a fellow that's the biggest restaurant guy I know. He's probably got 250 restaurants now, all different types of restaurants. Been doing it forever. Started with Wendy's. He had his group sent him to Memphis. This was 20 years ago to a restaurant. It was a restaurant, but they're known for their hamburgers. And they said, "We want you to spend 3 days there and see what this guy's doing." And he went. And after 3 days, he went to the guy that owned the place. And he said, "I got some questions." He said, "First of all, your floor staff." He said, "I noticed, you know, who's in charge?" He said, "Well, nobody." And he said, "Well, no, who trains the people?" They said, "When somebody new comes in, they just get together." "What, when somebody quits, how do you hire a new server?" He said, "They get together, they know somebody comes in." He said, "Well, in the kitchen, I've noticed who trains the kitchen guys?" He said, "They just all in there together, they figure it out. But what happens when the fry cook doesn't show up? Somebody knows somebody, they bring somebody else in, they hire somebody, and they, who trains them? They just figure it out while they're back there." He said, "All right." He said, "What about the money? Who takes care of the money?" He said, "Well, you know, in the back office, those brown paper bags, all the servers put their sales in there, and they put the bags back on that sofa." And he said, "Well, who takes it to the bank?" He said, "Whoever gets there first in the morning." And my friend looked at the guy, and he said, "This place isn't managed at all, is it?" And he said, "Uh-uh." And remarkably successful.
This isn't Utah. This is your friend who has
this 250. Tennessee. Okay. There's a restaurant in Memphis.
So if you're talking about this guy and what, I mean, if you were to take that a few layers, I mean, thank you for getting into that, but what is happening here? If you could put the words to why this is working under his roof, like what elements need to exist in order for that level of trust to exist?
You're talking about this store right here?
No, I'm talking about the example you were just sharing with us.
That guy that I told you about, he is the most, he writes his own codes. He's got 128 of one kind of, he's totally micromanages everything. It blew him away.
I'm confused. I think I might admit. So this gentleman that you were talking to, who was asking all the questions, he has 250 locations. Was he talking about this place?
No. He was talking about a place in Memphis, Tennessee. They sent him to a restaurant.
And what's this place in Memphis, Tennessee?
I'm not going to mention the name of the restaurant. Okay, but.
Gotcha. So he was going to learn from successful operation so he could apply those lessons.
It was the antithesis of his approach to everything, and it still is.
Yeah.
The point is, you can get there a lot of different ways.
100%.
You don't have to follow Danny Meyer or the unreasonable hospitality guy. There's 1,000 ways to get there. And but if you're not authentic in your approach, it's going to show. And those guys run brilliant restaurants. But that's in their nature, the way they do it. It's not my nature.
So I think the core thing that I pulled out of that is authenticity in the approach. So there's a million and one different in what you're saying. 100, as somebody who's interviewed over 1,076 restaurant owners across the country to try to distill, just like this guy who was going there to learn. That's what this podcast is all about: going to people who are successful and learning, looking for patterns. And I've about drove myself crazy trying to distill it, because the more I get into it, the more I've learned that there's a million and one different ways, and you have to reverse engineer your approach for you, your strengths, your values, your vision, whatever. Like, we're all different, and there's different ways. It depends on what you're trying to do. It all depends. There's so many variables. So my hope through this podcast, people listening can hear all the different perspectives and manifest and craft their own way that works well for them.
Yeah, and I mean, and things are way different if you're talking to somebody who has a restaurant. You can do whatever you want with a restaurant. If you're going to have a bunch, multiple restaurants, it gets a little bit more difficult to have those restaurants fall under some sort of theme of operation. If it's the Bright Star in Bessemer, Alabama, that's been there over 100 years, those fellas, they run it the way they want to run it, and it's done really well. Now, you probably couldn't do two of them or three of them.
Why is that?
It's just innate. Well, they're there all the time working their ass off.
Because they can't recreate themselves.
Yeah, and other people don't. And that's what you've seen. you know, the great restaurants are going to be 80-seat restaurants where the owner chef is cooking and somebody in his family's running the door and kit. That's going to be the great restaurants. But what happened in the, I would say, the late 80s and 90s, a lot of these world, when chefs became famous, they weren't chefs weren't famous when I was a kid, but when they became TV stars and famous, you can only make so much money in an 80-seat restaurant. And so they started opening up more.
And that bigger.
Yeah, more and bigger and lots of them.
Yeah. So what I'm, one thing I'm curious about before we really start to kind of dissect who you are and the big takeaways of, if, you know, if I can just put you in a bottle, right? The things that are unique about you and how you've become successful. Looking again at where you are today, you said you had one concept with six locations. In 2005, how many total locations did you have?
I can't remember.
You can't remember. When did you scale the most? Like when did you, when did you get to six locations with Chuck's Fish?
We've been open a restaurant every couple of years, and we've had some that didn't work. So okay. The ones that have stayed and made it, and all the ones that make it, they're all based on this restaurant right here. We have, if the restaurants that we have now serve seafood and sushi, and one of the things that happened 35 years ago, I found a woman at a little Korean place down here, Yoshia Eddings, and I tricked her into coming here and doing sushi, and I didn't know what we were doing, but she did. And for 35 years, she has trained customers throughout the South on sushi. People, way more people know her than they know me, and that the reason that it worked was because a sushi bar in the South in the 90s and, you know, 30 years ago, you couldn't find four people. Hey, let's all go eat sushi. But we do it. We're one of the rare places where you can eat sushi and I can get a ribeye steak and this person can get a blackened grouper and somebody can get stuffed shrimp. And we made sushi accessible without it being a sole offering. And that's what all those restaurants do. All the Chucks do.
Okay.
Tremendous sushi sales. And that's, again, that's because people trust us with seafood.
Got it. I guess one of the things I'm curious about is if you take that path, I gave the two examples of left being super culture driven, right being super systems driven. I've seen that it's hard to scale the concepts on the left that are super culture driven because it's harder to scale culture than it is to scale systems.
No question.
So how have you been able to scale culture is what I'm getting at.
Well, I mentioned earlier, we opened, the thing that drives us most to open restaurants is when we get staffs that are top heavy and we're going to lose some really good people unless we open a restaurant. So we generally, we hire from within, which everyone would love to do. And those are people that already know our culture.
The culture carriers.
Yeah. You know, that's worked for us. But again, we have no tempo. We have no plans for 2026 or 2027 or 2020. We have nothing, no plans. We don't plan on having 20 stores or 15 stores. Or we're doing it. The next one will be in Huntsville, Alabama. And then at some point we'll say, we'll go do another one.
Mm. How many partners do you have?
And those restaurants really have one, Chris Eddings, who's been working here since he was 14, and he's our sushi chef's son.
Okay.
We have investors, but he's the only working partner that I've got.
And then you have the market partner, right?
The market, Tony, and one other fellow, Shannon Johnson.
Okay. What have you learned about partnerships?
Well, these are people I've grown up with. I mean, the partners I've got, Chris is 30 years. Those guys are 38 and 39 years, and they weren't partners when it started. So I can't imagine hiring a partner online or something like that.
Right.
You know, these are people that are,
they're almost like family.
Yeah, and I like having partners.
Why do you like having partners?
Well, because I'm certainly not always right, and it's nice to get other opinions, and it's nice for other people to work when I don't want to. And it's also nice I would like for the people who have been around me for this long to all be very successful at every level.
Right. What, when you're thinking about partnership, what are you looking for in a partner? There's one word that comes to my mind that I feel like would...
Well, you like honesty in everything you do, but I like people that... I like people that I get along with. Yeah. They need to be... We don't have to have the same political views or what we do for fun. We none of that, but we got to have something that we that brings us together.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to go as far as saying the future restaurants, the best restaurants in the future are going to be restaurants that are owned by multiple people. I don't think that as the market gets more and more competitive, as there's more expectation from what from the consumer, from like social like social media presence, and like I mean, there's so many elements that you have to consider today to run a successful restaurant. I don't think you can physically do it by yourself unless you're a freak of nature and you have that many talents. I think if you're trying to build something, you want trying to scale something, there's no way you can do it alone anymore.
I don't know about that. We have a variety of investors that are in all of our stuff, but when it comes to working with folks, I don't know. We have different all kinds of techniques for profit sharing that people can make a whole lot of money that work for us without being partners in the sense that they're actual.
I'm a huge proponent of profit sharing. Mm-hmm. Can you get into the details of how that's structured if people want to recreate it in their restaurants?
Well, we break things down really between alcohol, food, and sushi. And so the people that are in charge of those different areas, we've got all kinds of incentives.
So in the back end, you're tracking all the cash flow that come in for those verticals, bar, sushi, food.
Yeah.
And then you say the cash flow from the sales from these items gets allocated into separate. How do you guys track it?
Is it quarterly.
Quarterly? Okay. Is there software in the back end that's helping you track it?
No.
Just money that goes into the checking accounts gets allocated?
No. Now we have our bookkeepers and accountants are in Birmingham, and they've got a system that they...
Okay. Yeah. I mean, what are the benefits of profit sharing?
The benefits of profit sharing?
Yeah.
They've got skin in the game. You know, we do better, they do better. Sometimes it's really difficult to scale salaries and wages when you've got a whole lot of people to keep up with it. Hey, is so-and-so due for a raise? I can't remember. It's that's
you want a raise, go earn it.
Yeah.
Like literally in volume, in cash flow. Right. I think it's a great
point. If we're not profitable, nobody benefits. So
right.
That's a luxury.
Right. One thing I think that hasn't come out of today's conversation that I'm interested in pulling back more layers on, because your success hinges so much on relationships and people and culture. You said that the only rule you have is don't be late. But when you're hiring people, what are you looking for? Is it to the point you were making earlier when you were sharing the story of the other gentleman, where is it all kind of organic of a friend of a friend? Or
I mean, we certainly look for their experience, their work experience. But I would say our biggest question, we ask them straight up if they're a nice person. And that usually throws people for a loop. Those people will kind of say, well, of course I am. But we like to work with nice people.
Yeah. How do you really know if they're nice or not? I mean, I feel like if anybody was asked that question, they'd probably say yeah. I mean, how many people is going to say I'm an
a-hole?
You
just have to analyze how they say yeah. And you know, we don't there's so many things that we don't care about at all. You know, ethnicity, race, sexuality, none of that stuff matters to us in any real way, in any way. But being nice does. And we don't even have a dress code. Our restaurants don't have dress codes. I never wanted people to tell me how to dress when I was young. I don't want to tell them. And when you, we don't do that sort of stuff when everyone's coming. Good evening. My name's Robert. I'll be your server tonight. Have you been here before? We don't do any of that yet.
Yeah.
You know, can I get you a drink? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of business and your business success, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you think you should speak to before we move on to the next focus of today's conversation?
You know, our experience in this area where we've been the longest is tourist areas are tricky. College towns were in Tallahassee, Athens, Georgia, and Tuscaloosa. You know, I read an article in the New York Times 20 years ago, and it said college towns avoid recessions. And we were just about to have one here. That's what steered me to Tuscaloosa. And then we found out when I grew up, there was Cornell and FSU, I think, had the only hotel and restaurant schools in the country. Now every college has one. And they've got them at Georgia and FSU still in Alabama. But not just that, the workforce is amazing because you got kids, first of all, they're smart. And secondly, we're getting kids that are working their way through school. Well, that tells you something right there. They've got to be able to manage their time, their schoolwork. And so, and we've got kids that major in anthropology. We got kids that are in law school and they get out and can't find a job. And if they're really, really good at what they do, we do everything we can to encourage them to stick with us. And so we've developed sort of a minor league system that's worked really well, which allows us to open other restaurants.
Okay, I'm going to pause here. We're going to take a break to thank our sponsor. When we come back, I want to unpackage that.
This episode is brought to you by Mies. Running the back of house brings a whole suite of challenges, like distributing intellectual property from your chef's brain to your back of house team across all of your locations. Once that information gets distributed, you still have to train your back of house to ensure the recipes are being executed accurately and consistently. Once everybody is trained, you still have to nail down profit calculations, which can be a nightmare when your team doesn't fully understand theoretical food costs, factoring in yields, and unit conversions. Then, once all this is done, you still have to push the information across all of your locations in real time, factoring in the prices that are constantly changing. Are you kidding me? That's where Mies comes in. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary intellectual property and stay in sync as a team. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yields of your ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. Ugh. With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps. And reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website. We cannot forget Lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit Owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust Owner.com to power their restaurants online.
We are back, and I can't remember what we were talking about just before we break for sponsors, because you pulled me outside and you showed me the boats, and thank you for doing that. They're beautiful, by the way. And we're just sitting here racking our brains trying to figure out what we're talking about before we walked away from the microphones. But you shared some really good nuggets just now before we officially came back. You mentioned Danny Meyer and how he finds people, and like he was giving advice about the three types of people there are. You also said you hate this idea of giving back to the community. Let's lead with that. Why do you hate that expression, give back to the community?
Well, it's ubiquitous. That's what restaurants tend to do, whether they do it or not. But if anybody... Every restaurant we've got, we are the community. We think of this as not just in the heart of Destin. We are the heart of Destin. We've been here longer than anybody, and we've managed. We do things that we like to do. Our restaurants, we have a program called American Lunch that one of my sons came up with, and we have food trucks that deliver food 3 days a week throughout the communities that they are, that they're in, for free. And the food comes out of our kitchens. It's not a food truck where the food's prepared on the truck. They're prepared in our certified kitchens, and we just deliver the food, and no questions asked. We feed whoever's hungry. We do Thanksgiving dinners at our restaurants. This restaurant does 2,000 people every Thanksgiving, no charge at all. And we feed lots of people who have not a penny, and we feed some wealthy people that live nice checks. It goes to Habitat for Humanity.
I was in town last night, and I was at a winery tasting. Oh, man, I should know the name of the winery. But there was a gentleman that was there that's local, and they're like, oh, why are you in town? And he said, I'm here to interview Charles Morgan. And then I was like, does the name sound familiar? And they're like, everyone's like, yeah, we know Charles Morgan. And the Thanksgiving, he mentioned that, mm-hmm. that you have a dinner every Thanksgiving. Is it free? Just
100% free.
Is there donations? Like he was mentioning something about the donations.
People that are capable of making them leave donations, and there are no questions asked of those who don't. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is the stuff. It's like, and I think what you said, this idea of giving back to the community, when you were saying that, it was making me think of culture. We always, like, today there's a lot of talk, jargon around culture. Like what is your culture? Like, what is your mission statement? What is your vision? What are your core values? And you write it down, and you put it in a folder. Or maybe you might put it on the walls. And you're like, that's our culture, right? And then you fuck off and you go do something else mm-hmm. every day. The culture isn't what you say you are. The culture is what you do every day. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I was thinking about when you said, you know, screw this, give back to the community, be the community.
Well, if people think giving back to the community is sponsoring little league teams, we take it a little bit more seriously than that.
Well, I mean, it's just like, and what I'm hearing from you is like, you care about your people and you don't just say that you do. You don't talk a big game. You do it with actions. And when you were the first time we took a break and I was talking to your partner and I was like, what is it about Charles that I need to know? He said that, like, you just care. Like you said, you bailed him out of jail a couple times. You've got him a lawyer a couple times. When you show up for your people, you care for your people, you're there for your people. It's hard for them to look away from you. You know, like it's hard for them to forget that. And that's loyalty. I've met two people, I've at least heard about two people who've been here since their early 20s. They're in their 40s or 50s now. Like, the only way you get that kind of loyalty is by giving it.
Well, one of the things when it comes to community that we do and have found it to be very valuable, we offer, and particularly in the college towns, to the people that work for us, if they'll spend 100 hours a year for any 501c3, our American Lunch Program, for anything that the local animal shelter, whatever, we pay them to do that. So it gets kids that are 18, 19, 20 years old that have really never had an opportunity to contribute in a way like that. They get to do it and they get to feel what it's like and they get to meet people. And it's, that's building culture.
I remember what we were talking about before we went for break. We were talking about the people and how there are people that come that work for you that are anthropologists, that are lawyers, are in school. When you find good people, you try to recruit them. You try to give them a home here. You try to, and you were also pointing out that there are more and more hospitality programs nationwide than ever before. I think that there's that as we march into the future, as AI gets better, as technology improves, people are going to be out of work. But one of the few industries that has longevity, in my opinion, is the hospitality industry. Finish that. Do you agree or disagree?
No, I agree.
Why?
Well, you know, it just makes sense. We're more interested. The Culinary Institute, you know, hats off to those folks. I know Robert St. John's kids went to school there and lots of people did that. That's not us. The hotel and restaurant school scattering, I'm sure they're learning something in those schools, but it's not really pertinent so much to what we do. And we're looking for somewhat fully, we don't care what their background is, what their avocations are. We're looking for relatively well-rounded people that give a shit. And if they do, it's not just when they're on the clock with us, but in life in general, that they care, they have their own goals and we like to help them reach them. But we try to surround ourselves with people that we want to be around.
Yeah. It's that simple and it's that hard, you know, when you're, cause I think if you're aggressive, and one thing that's unique about you and what you do here is that scale isn't really on your radar. Like you said, you don't have a plan, you don't have goals. You just take care of people and you surround yourself with people you like. And if you're not trying to scale, if you're not trying to grow, I think that's when you get in trouble and you get the wrong people, because you need to put somebody in that seat, regardless of whether or not they're the right person in the seat, because you have to fill those roles to scale. And I think that's the danger in scaling, is you often find the wrong people. But if you just make it strictly, and this is culture, right? This is human. This is the human side. If you just make it strictly about the relationships and the quality of the relationships, and that's the only damn thing that matters, then you have longevity. You have lasting. It's a slow game. It's a long game.
Well, that's so much more important, what you just said, than studying, reading books, taking courses in leadership. You know, the great leaders that I've been around, I don't think they've ever paid attention to the leadership tricks on Instagram or the books that come out on a fairly regular basis. It's not that complicated. It doesn't take a book to get across. You know, people that aren't going to be leaders, the book's not going to help them.
It's not complicated, but it seems hard, right? It seems hard to do those things because we struggle with it. Clearly, we struggle with the conversations we've had off camera about people not doing the right thing. It's hard to do the right thing. If it wasn't hard, why don't more people do it?
Big question there. I don't know, but I disagree. I don't think it's in the restaurant realm, in life, in politics, in the world, doing the right thing. That might get complicated, and people are conflicted about different things. In this building, not that hard.
What is the secret to making that happen? If you could just distill it, if there's one takeaway from today's podcast about your success, who you are, and I think the big focus in what you do is in culture. What is it? Just hiring the right people? But can you take it a step further than that?
That's really difficult. Hiring the right people. You do all you want to do. You're not going to hit on that every time. But attracting the right people. Once you get open, having people come to you, not you scrambling around on the internet looking for workers, but having people that have come to you because of something they've heard or people they know that work for you. The greatest emissaries we have are the people that are already on the payroll.
Yeah. Charles, I'm really enjoying today's conversation, man. These are the kind of chats that I like, is in, you know, really what I'm trying to do. You know, the restaurant industry, I feel like your job as a restaurant owner is to empower your team and to give them the tools and resources they need to be successful and to show them what the job done right looks like, and then empower them to do it, right? But where does the restaurant owner go to see what the job done right looks like? And if I'm trying to change the industry, I want to give them a picture of you, people like you who have values. And yes, there is something to be said about scalability and profitability and money, but at the same time, there's something to be said about being the neighborhood, giving naturally to the neighborhood and pulling instead of pushing, right? And being a leader. And I know you kind of just harped on leadership and all that, but like, I love making an example of people like you who just have the values that you have.
Well, I don't know so much about values, but I do know for many years I underestimated the value that we have in providing jobs for people, good jobs. And that's really, it's talking about doing things in the community, that's up way up on the list. Being a job provider, a good job provider, and that's very important, and that's one of the beauties, one of the things that makes this life livable. You know, when you open your doors in the restaurant, you're open to the public. You have no earthly idea who's walking through that door. But we do have some control over the staff that's here to greet them. And there's so many things, again, that I don't care about. These people are giving us 40 hours a week of their lives. I have almost no concern about what they do when they're not here, as long as they're healthy and having fun and doing well. I'm pulling for them, but we don't drug test. You know, we went through some 401k thing where they were going to drug test our employees. I said, have you ever looked in our kitchen?
Yeah,
like, fuck! I just lost my kitchen. These guys smoke pot. I said, and I could care less, you know. And if you're going to drug test somebody, pot stays in your system for however long. I could care less what they're doing on the weekend nights when they're not here, as long as you're healthy, you know. But so we support our people in a lot of ways, and then we take a step back. go do your thing. But, yeah, you know, when we're here, we all pull together and do the best we can.
Yeah. So if the mission statement, if we're going to change the world by transforming the restaurant industry, what has to change about the world? And how does the restaurant industry get behind that to make it happen?
Well, again, when you talk about the restaurant industry, wow, it's a big, broad, varietal, you know, like people talk about the most popular ethnic foods in this country, whether it's Mexican or Italian. Well, when they talk about Mexican, they're including Taco Bell. When they're talking about Italian, they're including Domino's Pizza. And I don't have much experience in those sorts of fast food, multi-unit things. I think, you know, we try to look as we try not to look corporate, and it's not hard for us because we're not. But the large chain corporate restaurants that do have all kinds of business applications that we don't. You know, this country's become, when you travel, if you don't watch out, you can eat in the same restaurant here that you ate in Kansas City and San Diego and El Paso, Texas. So we're big proponents of locally owned local restaurants, and all businesses face that problem.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest, it's getting harder and harder for the mom and pops to compete with the big chains of the world, right? So what can we do to change that? How can we be conscious about it and be intentional with messaging, and like what has to happen in order to not lose what you just
said? Well, I think in a lot of ways, mom and pop restaurants have a giant advantage over chain restaurants.
Absolutely.
You have to know how to work it. But
they're still getting harder and harder to keep open.
Sure seems like it.
So what's happening? What needs to happen in order for us to stop that trend?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't expect you to have all the answers.
I don't have that answer.
but it's fun to talk about, right? It's fun to kind of brainstorm, like, what can we do? I think in my conversations, I'll just throw this out there, I think it starts with the consumer. I think if the restaurant industry is going to change the world, I think it starts with educating the consumer about where they put their money and how their decisions affect the bigger picture.
Yeah. And, you know, when corporate restaurants have a much more difficult time to be a part of a community than independent restaurants. They just don't know how to do it. I mean, a corporate restaurant here, they might sponsor a little league team, or they might toss in a check for something, some food drive. But to be part of the heartbeat of a community, we got a big jump on that. We know everybody. We know everybody here. It's a lot easier for us to do that than it is for a corporate restaurant that's run out of Dallas.
I think part of the solution is making an example of people like you who have these values, because there's thousands of restaurant owners listening to this, and they're comparing themselves to you and your values, and they're going to be a little bit more self-aware of what the impact they have in their community is, and the choice, the vision they have for themselves, and where they want to be after 40 years. So thank you for being that example. You know, I love the values.
Well,
know.
and the corporate restaurants have got advantages in terms of consistency and the way they run their operations and the money that they have and the facilities they can build. But it takes them, they're slower creatures. It takes them longer to move. If I've got a porter up here that's in trouble, we can help them real quick.
Yeah.
It takes a lot longer to go through the hierarchy of whatever the management system is.
Running up the chain.
Yeah, and so we don't have a chain.
Yeah, it's flat. That's one thing that I actually wanted to mention earlier. Have you ever heard of the expression of entangled organization? Or it's called it's a line from Tom Walter, his book, It's My Company Too. And that's something I'm happy that you brought that up, because I think one thing that I've identified about your company is that it's a flat hierarchy, where if I were to walk in and somebody who could have been anybody, could be some 30-year-old kid, could walk up to you, or you could watch them, and you don't know who the owner is. You don't know who the boss is, because everybody treats it like they own it, because everybody knows what the job, like the values. Everyone lives the values every day. I think you're a shining example of what an entangled organization is, where you don't know who's who because everybody treats it like they own it. So, I mean, the great book, Tom Walter, It's My Company Too. If you were listening to this, you want to check that out. But I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about, I kind of pulled you off the subject of the broken food system relative to the oceans. And I said we can come back and talk about that. What has to change in order for us to save our oceans? Because it sounds like this is a subject that you're really close to and you care about.
Well, there's so many more restrictions now than there were 20 years ago, particularly on commercial fishing. And that's going to make for a healthy fishery in a lot of ways. At the same time, commercial fishing, recreational fishing is off the hook, particularly here. And that's a problem. It's a tough deal. You know, the whole nature that seafood can move worldwide in airplanes now, and it didn't used to do that. It's going to get more expensive, and it's going to get harder to get.
Do you think that's good that it gets more expensive? Should it get more expensive?
It's just the market. There's just people don't. That's the last wild protein they are. And fish. It's not like chickens, hogs, and cows. These fish, these boats I just showed you, they're subject to bad weather. They're subject to fish not biting.
Yeah.
They're subject to all kinds of stuff. And so it's now that's this. That doesn't affect farm-raised fish, which is a huge number. You know, there are fish that are raised in Thailand, tilapia, that are raised under hog pens.
Yeah, they eat poop.
Yeah, and those fish are processed there. They're frozen there. They're shipped to Los Angeles. They get to Cisco or whoever distributes them. They're distributed all over the country, and they often end up on a menu as red snapper. And if you take a fillet of fish and batter it and fry it, it's very difficult to tell. If you don't see the whole fish, it's hard to know what you're getting. And there are very few people that are willing to pay the price for real fresh fish.
So what can the restaurant owners listening to this do to be a part of the solution?
Well, they've tried before. They've done things like with swordfish. All the chefs in the Northeast banned swordfish from the menus. Well, that was about 20 years ago. And now, remarkably, so we caught 5 swordfish on the poppy one night last year. Swordfish have come back. So there are fish that respond to...
Yeah, they're resilient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a tough deal. Who could have foreseen that seafood would have been this popular 25, 30 years ago? It wasn't. Right. There wasn't fish across the country like there is now.
I think one thing that's happening is we're starting to, what they call trash fish, right? Your non-traditional fish.
That would be mullet and Spanish mackerel. People tend not to. On the East Coast.
Can I see a photo of you holding a giant Spanish mackerel? Is that it right there on that water?
That's my dad. Tournament he won with that king mackerel. Yeah, people here don't eat king mackerel. I saw
that photo and I said, holy mackerel. That's a big one.
The mackerel that come here, we sell to Canada because there's really no market for king mackerel here. On the East Coast, people eat bluefish and Spanish mackerel. Nobody here's ever eaten a bluefish, right? Ever.
Yeah. I mean, so I think, again, it comes back to the restaurant owner making decisions.
Yeah. Selling fish.
Not reacting to the market, but I think there's a point. We've reached a point where the market starts to has to start reacting to us.
Yeah, and that should happen. And the ironic thing is Spanish mackerel, bluefish, mullet, they're fishy. They're oily.
Yeah.
They're the fish that are good for you.
That's, you know what? You just hit on something. If I've learned anything, the consumer only does what's in it for them. They have to know. In order for the consumer to change, anybody, it's part of marketing. People don't buy what you say. They buy the benefits. And you have to, people are selfish. You have to sell the benefits. And when you start taking, I think our saving grace is that when you source food sustainably, whether it be from the earth or from the ocean, that product is healthier. It's better. When you do things the way it's meant to be, it's better for the environment. It's also better for the human. And once people start to realize the only way I can be the healthiest version of myself is by eating the purest food or the food that, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
well, the other thing is those fish are much less expensive. So
yeah.
People in the South want to eat snapper and grouper. Right. White, mild fish.
Save money, eat healthier. Yeah. Tell me the market won't get behind that.
Yeah.
Those are huge benefits. And I think that's what we have to market those benefits, because people only buy benefits and they're selfish. And I think health is like, The future of food is medicine. People are going to start seeing food as medicine. And I think we have to lean into that. This has been a lot of fun, Charles. Thank you so much. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions to wrap it up, and we'll be done in a couple minutes. So what is one thing about your business, a value, a process, a system that's truly uncommon that makes you unstoppable?
We require our employees to be on time.
I love that. That's
an amazing thing these days.
It's easier said than done, right? Uh-huh. 100%.
It's actually pretty easy, but it's rarely done.
Right. True. So we've kind of identified this issue that if we're going to transform the industry, we're here to transform the industry, right? But how have you, I think if we're going to do it, it's going to be by transforming one person at a time, right? So how have you personally transformed? Who are you today versus the man you were in 1979?
Oh, Jesus. Well, I'm more experienced. I've just seen a lot. There's very little that in this world that I haven't dealt with. So the people that I work with, if they have questions, they're be hard to shock me with something. And our world, our society, not just the restaurants, but in general, our world has changed so much since the 70s.
Better or worse?
Oh, I think probably better. I mean,
I'm happy
in,
that you think
in
that.
Lots of ways. I'm an optimistic person, but what our mores and what was allowable in those days is not anymore. And a lot of it you see with women in the restaurant business, the way that look how many how many wonderful female chefs there are now. Then that just was not something they could do in the 1970s.
Yeah.
There was just a handful of well-known women chefs.
Yeah, there's definitely a shift happening right now. I think it's a necessary shift. And I think it's weird because all we see on social media is that when it doesn't, examples of that shift not happening. And I think we forget how far we've come and we're moving in the right direction, but it doesn't feel like that way sometimes. So I'm happy that you are echoing that sentiment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the last question. If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow. All the memories of you, your work, and your restaurants would be lost with your departure, with the exception of three pieces of wisdom that you could leave behind for your legacy and for the good of humanity, for your community. What would those three pieces of wisdom be?
I would think that life is way too short to spend it working with people that you didn't appreciate and enjoy.
One.
I would think that you need to derive pleasure from your business that transcends the core aspect of your business. And in general, that would come from relationships you build with customers.
Two.
I think restaurants too often don't. People are shy about or reluctant to voice opinions on issues outside of the restaurant, whether it's politics or social issues. I think those are definitely in the reasonable thing for restaurant owners, for restaurant people to address publicly. And I've done that, and it has certainly in many ways been detrimental to business. We're in a very conservative political area, and I am not that, and nobody here misunderstands what I think about equal rights and justice and politics in general. And so, but I've made a career of that, and apparently people like fresh seafood more than they're concerned about my political identity. So thank goodness for that.
Fortunately, good. I mean, I can get behind that 100%. I think that is a testament to this fact that this industry is going to change the world because we say what we think. And that's why I love the people in this industry because they're not worried about quote unquote professionalism being bland, being normal so they can get along with a lot of people. They want to get along with the people they like, and they're going to be exactly who they are, and that's going to change the world.
I think in this restaurant right now in particular, if you polled before you leave, you could do it visually, or you could ask someone, I'll bet you that right now there are people from six or maybe seven different nationalities working here this minute, all different racial and ethnic backgrounds, all kinds of different sexual the way that they
preference
whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I think having all those folks work together, it makes you realize, why can't everything else be this diverse and still moving forward and getting something done?
And with all the diversity that there is, at the end of the day, we're more alike than we're different.
Yeah.
We just want to be seen, loved, and valued. It's all that matters. I love this conversation. I'm here because Robert St. John said, Eric, I have a list of people you need to get on in the Southeast. You're on that list. You're actually at the top of that list. Yeah. Who do you respect and admire? I don't know this market like you know this market. Who is doing it right? Who is profitable? Who has the culture? Who's making opportunity for other people? Who can we make an example of?
You talking about in this area?
Anywhere in the country or this area, like you know better than I do.
For different reasons, the McNally group of restaurants, Balthazar, Pastis, Minetta Tavern, Keith McNally's a different kind of guy, but he's outspoken and knows how to put a restaurant together and is incredible with his workers. And he's got good food, not great, but it's plenty good. And from a restaurant standpoint, that's who I would say I admire the most.
Was that McNally?
McNally.
Okay. What was the first name?
Keith.
Keith McNally.
Balthazar's, his flagship restaurant in New York. My daughter, I have a daughter in New York that works in the food business. My daughter here runs meals. We've got my two sons run restaurants. So our family's in it, and they'd all have but I have people that I really respect and lean on and ask questions to. They're the best people at Fresh Hospitality. They're people that out of Nashville, they help me a lot. There are lots of folks I admire in the restaurant business.
Well, if you can think of more later on, please let me know. I'm always looking to make an example of the next person. And look out, folks. I'm coming after you if you were just mentioned. And how can we connect with you if maybe you want to come join your team, be mentored by you underneath your tutelage as an employee, or maybe we just want to follow you in your work. Is there social handles you can drop on us, emails you can drop on us?
Say again now.
Maybe an email or social handles. I don't know if you're on Instagram.
Charles Morgan III on Instagram. That's all I do.
Got it. Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles.
Hey, thanks.
This is where I say there is no questioning, my man. You are unstoppable.
Thanks, Eric.
Cheers. Thank you. There's another episode wrapped up here at Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to our guest today, Charles Morgan, for coming on. And, you know, just when I think I have it figured out, I meet somebody like Charles Morgan, and you know, one way I know how to explain it is that everything in life has bounds. Everything in life has extremes. And I feel like in the restaurant industry, the extremes in terms of whether or not you can be successful are extreme chaos and extreme order. And generally the most successful brands are in the middle with a balance of chaos and order. And when I use the word chaos, I feel like relative to the restaurant industry, that's a strong culture. It's the people element side of things. It's the human side of things that's strong. And then the order is the systems, the processes, the protocols, the standards, operating procedures, all this stuff. So what I love about Charles and his story is that he is a shining example of an extreme of just taking care of your people, loving your people, and doing the right thing for your people, and surrounding yourself with amazing people that you can be extremely successful. And the words straight out of his mouth that he's not a systems person. You can have extreme success in this industry without those things. Do I recommend it? Probably not, but I think it's living proof. Charles Morgan, what he's done is built a restaurant group on the foundation of trust and respect. And I think that's really cool. So if you guys are enjoying this podcast and you want more content just like this, please support what we're doing. There's a ton of ways you can support. You can share this. You can leave us a review. If you are enjoying this podcast, leave us a review. Let us know what you think. You can Use our links and support our sponsors. When you use our links and support our sponsors, they know that it's worth supporting and sponsoring the show, and they come back and they buy more ad space. It's that simple. And I really do vet our sponsors. So thank you in advance for using those links and supporting our sponsors. And then lastly, you can join our community. Head over to Facebook and join our Unstoppable Restaurant Owners and Operators Facebook group, where we are recording all of our live events and hosting those live events over there. And then also you can join the conversation. You can be a part of the conversation by joining Restaurant Unstoppable Network. Thank you in advance when you do that. So can't say goodbye without saying thank you to the people who make this show possible. Thank you to Jared Parisi for your copyright and editing. And, you know, honestly, as we go into the future, your role as co-producer. And thank you to Callan Miola, our community manager, who's crushing it. Takes an army. Mine is slowly growing. And I'm so excited for the future. All right, guys, that's it for today. Until next time, peace out.